Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Berlin,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Hello and welcome to The Europeans. I'm Dominic Kramer in Amsterdam, here with Katie Lee in Paris. We're here to talk to you about Europe's politics, Europe's culture, and this week, for reasons that will soon become clear, Europe's potatoes. How are you doing today, Katie?
I'm good. Kobu's update, or Qbuzz as I was calling it. Anyway, that app, what you can play music on that isn't Spotify, finally downloaded it. Holy shit, song sounds so good on it. I love it.
It's really worth leaving Spotify for and paying that extra euro or two. I'm glad I've made another Kobu's evangelist out of you.
There's so many of them now as well. We've had quite a few messages, I think, from listeners saying, I switched to Kobu's because of Dominic. So Kobu's, we're doing free advertising over here for you. Get in touch.
Yeah, they're still not sponsoring us. What's going on?
But how are you over there in Amsterdam?
Yeah, I'm fine. I mean, whilst the post-war Western alliance has been falling apart this week, I was on stage choking on confetti.
Oh my God. What, like in a serious way?
Kind of serious, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a metaphor in there somewhere, like about the current geopolitical shit show and me choking on confetti. I haven't found it yet. It was basically just me inhaling confetti whilst trying to sing my lungs out, which was rather uncomfortable and humiliating, but I can laugh about it already.
What a weird celebratory way that would have been to die. I do always wonder about this at huge pop concerts where, you know, this thing explodes and loads of confetti comes down from the ceiling. Like, you can't be the first performer to have nearly died choking on confetti.
Absolutely. And it was really small confetti as well. So fortunately, that means I wasn't likely to choke to death, but it really meant like a lot of it got in my mouth when I took one of my deep singer breaths and then started coughing up on stage.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
I'm finding it much harder to find anything to laugh about with the geopolitical situation that we're finding ourselves in.
Yeah, it's a grim time. And, you know, even away from geopolitics and just looking at normal people's lives, we've been following the awful news of this train collision in Cordoba in southern Spain that happened on Sunday night. We still don't know very much about why that first train derailed and hit the other, coming in the other direction. So we're not going to be talking about it this week, but we are following this accident, which has claimed dozens of lives, and we are sending our love to Spain. But what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we have, I think, our first ever interview with a sitting government minister, a member of the UK's cabinet, no less. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by Nick Thomas Simmons, who is, amongst other titles, the Cabinet Office Minister for European Union Relations. We're going to be speaking to him because whilst Donald Trump has been behaving more and more like a 19th century imperialist monarch who's lost his mind, the UK has gradually been inching a little bit closer towards the EU for the first time since Brexit happened. That's coming up later, but first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Let's start with Good Week. Who are you giving Good Week to, Katie?
I am going to take up a suggestion from one of our listeners in Berlin, Sarah, who suggested in our Patreon chat that we should consider giving a Good Week to people who live in Berlin because they are in the midst of receiving 4,000 tons of free potatoes. There are potatoes galore up for grabs in the German capital right now. It is a Kartoffeln bonanza.
I have so many questions, which, I mean, I guess we'll get on to why Berliners are receiving free potatoes in a minute. But first, 4,000 tons, like, how many potatoes is that? What does that look like?
So 4,000 tons is 4 million kilos. I do actually buy potatoes in 1 kilo sacks. So just imagine like 4 million of those sacks of potatoes.
Wow.
Is that helpful for visualizing?
That is very helpful. And that is a lot.
Okay. Yeah, it is a lot. It's also equivalent to the weight of 1,000 Asian elephants. I don't know if you find that more helpful or less helpful, but there it is. Just imagine a truly vast quantity of potatoes, okay? It is like a jaw-dropping number of potatoes.
Okay, so why are Berliners getting all these free potatoes?
Well, this story begins on a farm outside Leipzig, a couple of 100 kilometers south of Berlin. This farm had a very good harvest. And actually, farms across a lot of Europe have had a very good potato harvest. Too good, it turns out. As a continent, we've been producing way more potatoes than people want to buy at the moment. Just to give you a sense of scale, in Belgium, it was reported in October that the national harvest at the end of the year was equivalent to half a ton of potatoes per Belgian resident. Wow. We have crazy numbers of potatoes. Anyway, this particular farm near Leipzig in Germany, they had a deal in place with a big produce trading company that was going to buy their potatoes. So far, so good. But because there are so many European farmers trying to sell potatoes right now, the price has plummeted. So the trading company that had agreed to buy these potatoes, it didn't want them anymore. They were like, we can't sell these at a price that is actually going to make money for us, especially once we take into account how much it would cost to transport this huge volume. We don't want them. We will pay you to keep them so that they're just not our problem. So this farm was left with a warehouse full of unsold potatoes. Now, this is not the first time that a farm has found itself with unsold potatoes. And there is apparently quite a standard solution for this, which is that the potatoes often get turned into biogas. But the volumes of potatoes that we're talking about here are just so immense that the farm was like, how would we even get them to the biogas plant? And are we really going to burn 40% of our harvest? Like, this just feels really wrong. Is there nothing else we can do? And what they decided to do was to get in touch with Ecosia, which you've probably heard of.
The search engine.
Yes. Ecosia is a search engine that plows all of its profits into protecting the environment. It's a company based in Berlin. And they had recently had a feature written about them in the Berlin Morgenpost, which is one of the city's local newspapers. So Ecosia got in touch with the newspaper and they were like, could you guys help spread the word and help us find something useful to do with these potatoes? Cynically, I am 100% sure that both of these companies saw this as a very nice opportunity to get some attention and generate some positive publicity for both of their brands. But I'm going to roll with it because I hate seeing wasted potatoes. So it is being dubbed the Great Potato Rescue Operation. And basically, what Ecosia and the Berlin Morgenpost are organizing is the trucking en masse of tons of these potatoes, most of them to Berlin, because that is where both of these companies are based, but also to the area around the farm, nearer to Leipzig.
So how exactly are they going to distribute all these potatoes in an orderly fashion? Like, presumably they're not just dumping them all in a big pile in the middle of Berlin somewhere.
Yeah, that would not be a good idea. That'd probably be a potato-based riot. So a load of the potatoes have gone directly to Berlin's main food bank, 22 tons of them, for distribution from there. But otherwise, what the campaigners have done, and it's quite clever, is that they have decentralized the potato distribution. So if you are a business or an organization in Berlin with a bit of space, you can sign up to receive a ton of potatoes. And you really do have to take a ton because they come in these massive bags. Like, you can't take half a ton and you definitely can't take half a kilo. And then these businesses and organizations have been handing out the potatoes to basically whoever wants them. According to our listener, Sarah, people have been snapping these potatoes up incredibly quickly wherever they've arrived. So if you live in Berlin, you can go to 4000tonnen.de, 4000 tons in German. And there is a map on the website of potato collection points around Berlin, along with the day that the potatoes are due to arrive there. So you can, yeah, head to your nearest collection point and pick up a bunch of free potatoes and make a nice, I don't know, like a nice leek and potato soup or something. Something wintry.
And do they think they're going to be able to distribute all these 4,000 tons of potatoes?
Well, no. So the organisers have been quite upfront about the limits of what they're going to be able to do. Last week, they managed to distribute 42 tons of potatoes. Not bad. This week, about 132 tons are being distributed, which is pretty amazing. However, there is a bout of cold weather coming after this week, which is really not good for the potatoes. It is also Ecosia and the Berliner Morgenpost who are putting up most of the funding for the transport of the potatoes. And yeah, they're only willing to put up a certain amount of cash into this, even if it is a good branding exercise. After this week, they are probably done, although they're looking for big buyers who might be willing to take more of the potatoes. But they almost definitely won't get anywhere close to redistributing 4,000 tons. And I assume that a lot of the rest will indeed probably get turned into biofuel. But it's cool that they've managed to give people even a fraction of this. You know, it's still a huge amount of free food that we're talking about. And of course, it's especially great that so much of it will have gone to the food bank and to Berliners who really struggle to buy enough food every week. Having said that, I do want to acknowledge that there has been some criticism of this initiative. It does feel like a kind of feel-good story about people power and preventing food waste, and it is. But there has been some quite sharp criticism from other German farmers. One farmer who gave an interview to the Taz newspaper, he said that this was essentially a marketing gimmick that is going to hurt other farmers. He pointed out that 4,000 tons is equivalent to the annual output in a normal year of a dozen farms, and that giving away these volumes will create disruptions in the market because, you know, people aren't going to need to go buy potatoes for a while. He said it was particularly a shame that people in Berlin who might ordinarily buy potatoes grown more locally or organically are instead going to be eating all of these industrial potatoes grown 200 kilometers away. The farm that they come from, I should say, it is actually gradually switching over to being organic, but these potatoes aren't organic. I don't know. I hear this farmer, but in the end, it's not actually 4,000 tons of potatoes that are going to be given away and eaten. So this farmer will probably end up seeing his favoured solution become a reality, which is that the bulk of them will end up going to a biogas plant.
Yeah, it is one of those like uplifting stories that also does feel a bit depressing that when so many people are starving in the world that like there's all this food here.
Yeah.
Why can't it get to the people that really need it? And I hope some of it is getting to some of the people that need it. But yeah, it also kind of reminds me of those images of these huge butter mountains that they had back in the day because of the way that European farming policy worked. Or wasn't that something? Is that a thing? Have I made it up?
No, that was a thing, yeah. The butter mountains were a quite infamous result of EU policy starting back in the 70s. Basically, after the war, we were struggling across Europe to produce enough food, which is how the Common Agricultural Policy was born in the early 60s. And what it meant at the beginning was that our governments promised to pay a certain minimum price to farmers for producing certain foodstuffs to give them an incentive to produce more. Now, usually what happens when the supply of a thing goes up is that the price goes down because there's more of it available for the people who want it. But with these minimum prices kicking in, it was like, oh, okay, if we have the comfort of knowing that we're definitely going to be able to get a certain price, even if there is loads of this stuff available, then sure, let's produce more milk or grain or whatever it is. This initially produced the desired effect, which was more food being available. But by the late 70s, it had led to way more of certain foods being produced than there was actually a demand for. So our governments, and then later the EU, would buy all of this surplus stuff to help the farmers out. And then they would have to store it for ages. Like, we literally saw governments having to figure out what to do with these insane quantities of milk. Like, can we turn it into powder? Can we turn it into cheese? The same thing happened to wine. Loads of perfectly good French wine has been turned over the years into industrial alcohol at the cost of hundreds of millions of euros of EU taxpayer.
What is industrial alcohol?
So like ethanol, basically. You might want to use it for industrial products, cleaning products, antiseptic.
Oh yeah, of course.
Quite a lot of different things. So yeah, quite a lot of that has come from our wine. Anyway, there have been many, many reforms to the Common Agricultural Policy since those huge surpluses back in the 70s and 80s. We've tried different things like putting quotas in, and we have moved away in general from guaranteeing farmers specific prices to just giving them subsidies, like giving them cash. And that has reduced this overproduction issue. over the years as we have tinkered with our farming policy. But, you know, I mean, the wine thing was still going on in the mid-noughties. And actually, even during COVID, fun fact, there was again a serious oversupply of French wine, and quite a lot of it got turned into hand sanitizer.
No way.
Mm-hmm. Suffice to say, we have been tinkering with how to intervene in the agriculture market for decades in Europe. And it is still a massive work in progress. It is incredibly difficult. We're trying to do different things, you know. We're trying to make sure that European farmers can survive in an increasingly hostile environment. We're trying to protect the land. We're trying to keep prices affordable for all of us who eat. We're trying to make sure that we can still feed ourselves as a continent if World War III breaks out. So many different things. So yes, we still do intervene aggressively in the agriculture market. And you're always going to find free marketers complaining that we shouldn't do this and it distorts the market and it's incredibly expensive for taxpayers. What I will say is that in the case of this huge sea of potatoes at the farm outside Leipzig, and in many other cases as well, you know, oversupply does happen often for reasons that don't have much at all with the way that we've intervened in the market. Right now, we have a lot of potatoes in Europe because the weather has been really favorable for growing potatoes. So the farmers are getting lower prices for it. And the big buyers who buy vegetables en masse and sell them to wholesalers and supermarkets, they don't want to buy all of these vegetables. There's actually a similar case in the Netherlands right now. Maybe you read about it. It's on a less epic scale, but there is a lot of cabbages up for grabs.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reporting on this. I think thanks to the warm and dry spring that we had. And I guess there's a risk that this will happen more and more thanks to climate change. Like certain crops will start doing very well if we have lots of warm and dry springs.
Yeah, and similarly to what's happening in Germany, the Dutch farmers are trying to work with campaigners and food banks to try and get as much as possible used rather than just left to waste.
I've just realised this is probably why on Christmas Eve when I went to the supermarket to Aldi in London, my parsnips were only 5p and
Whoa.
My red cabbage was only 5p. I really thought that there'd been a mistake and I was thinking, oh no, are the security cameras watching me? am I accidentally stealing this? And then I like went back to the place and saw that they were literally priced at 5p.
You're such a good boy. I love that that was your instinct. If it was me, I would just be grabbing piles of parsnips and running like the wind.
Isn't part of the problem also that like so many people only want pretty perfectly formed fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, and you know, there's plenty else wrong with the way that our food system operates. Like we haven't even talked about how used we've become to having tomatoes in December and how divorced we are in generally from any sense these days of like how nature works and how like seasons and harvest work.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I digress. Yes, the fact that we do only want pretty perfect fruits and vegetables is a big part of the problem. So if you do want to do your bit, there are plenty of initiatives around Europe that allow you to buy ugly seasonal fruit and veg, often at knockoff prices. One of our listeners in Belgium, Willem, he pointed out that they have this great initiative there called Waste Warriors that buys unwanted harvests and then turns it into soup and juice and stuff. And of course, there's Too Good To Go, this app, which I know exists in a lot of countries. You use it sometimes, don't you?
I do, yeah. Especially at the expensive bakeries that I can't really afford.
Nice. So there are loads of ways that you can help to do your bit to prevent food waste and often save money at the same time. So what is not to like? If you live in Berlin, though, go and get your hands on some of these potatoes and let me know what you're going to do with them. It's quite funny. I read a lot in the German media about this great potato rescue operation. And what I read is absolutely confirmation that Germans take potatoes really seriously, because every Q&A that I read included the question, are these potatoes of a waxy variety or a flowery variety?
Important question.
Very important question. It really affects what you want to do with them. In case you're wondering, these are agria potatoes, which are towards the flowery end of the potato spectrum. So you might want to bake or mash them rather than boiling, steaming or roasting. Our listener, Sarah, who brought the story to our attention in the first place, she is hoping to get her hands on some of these potatoes at the end of the week. There are some arriving in her neighborhood. She wrote to us, let's just say I'm doing more stalking of the delivery updates website than I am on work this week. And apparently she has her potato recipes at the ready. Have you got a favourite thing to do with potatoes, Dominic, that you'd like to recommend to people?
It's funny. I very rarely cook with potatoes. I'm much more of a kind of a pasta or rice guy.
Well, they're very cheap at the moment, so you might want to reassess that.
Oh, I know what I make. I'd make the Dutch national dish, the stampot.
Oh, lovely. Well, these would be perfect for that.
Well, I'm happy for Berliners anyway that they're getting Good Week, especially after they had that very bad few weeks when there was this power cut across big swathes of the city.
Yeah, which we didn't actually get to talk about on the podcast, but we did write about it in our newsletter. So plug, go and subscribe to our newsletter if you haven't already. The link is there in the show notes. Who has had a bad week?
I'm giving out a bad week to people who love free trade.
Ooh.
Partly to balance out your good week last week for people who love free trade.
I was going to say, what a turnaround.
Yeah, so those free trade lovers might be having a slightly worse week this week after some leaks to the European media outlined some plans from the European Commission about incorporating a made in Europe component to an upcoming piece of industrial legislation.
I'm so glad that you have decided to take on a complicated piece of industrial legislation this week. Yeah. And that finally I get the light week and I get to talk about potatoes.
Yeah, it's my turn to cosplay as an economics reporter.
So you say that there were some leaks to European media. Does that include us?
I wish. Actually, people, can you start leaking to us, please?
Yeah, we never get leaked stuff.
Hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Please leak to us.
Anyway, the draft bill was seen by Bloomberg, and I think Euronews saw a different document about the same piece of legislation, but I actually haven't seen any of these documents myself, sadly, so a lot of this is based on their reporting. The leaks are all about a piece of EU legislation called the Industrial Accelerator Act. Now, I realise that you may be inclined to skip forward immediately because that sounds incredibly boring, but please stay with me. I promise I will do everything to make this as painless as possible.
I'm going to set myself a timer to wake up in... How long do I need for this? 5 minutes? Seven minutes?
We'll see. Okay, I'll just talk to myself in the meantime then.
I'm here.
So I am framing this as a bad week for those lovers of free trade. But that's mainly because Katie had already taken Good Week for her German potato story.
Sorry.
Because actually I could just as well see it as potentially, depending on what you think about this kind of legislation, a good week for European industry.
Okay, yay. Is this that rare piece of good news that you're framing as bad news? Like, it never happens this way round. It's usually the other way round.
Yeah, I know, right? It could be. We'll see by the end. Anyway, do you want to know how this Made in Europe component would work?
Sure.
Okay, that was enthusiastic.
Go for it.
It seems like there are a few ideas being floated to help encourage European-made industry. One is that the European Commission wants to set new rules for key big foreign investments. We're talking investments above 100 million euros. Mm-hmm. Foreign companies making those kind of investments would be expected to hire a certain share of local European workers. Mm-hmm. They would be required to share technology. This is key. I'll come back to it in a bit. And to set up joint ventures with European firms. Then there are some rules that they're suggesting around public procurement processes. In normal speak, that basically means how governments and public bodies buy things or hand out contracts. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg says that the lowest price will no longer be the only deciding factor on who gets a contract. There will be strict requirements in member states for a minimum percentage of European origin content in purchased products. Are you still with me?
Genuinely, yes, I am. Like, I'm starting to perk up a bit because this means more money for Europe and I like money for Europe.
Yeah, so all this is meant to improve the state of European industry whilst at the same time encouraging large-scale decarbonisation in European industry as well.
What's not to like?
So on the face of it, this all might sound like good news for European industry, but it's not without controversy. When Politico reported in mid-December that these so-called made-in-Europe clauses could be folded into this industrial legislation, there was pushback, including from a group of 9 countries led by the Czech Republic, who warned that favouring European suppliers like this could end up undermining Europe's international trade.
Oh, interesting. So even though the idea is to bring us business, this plan is not actually universally adored within the EU.
No, it's definitely not. I don't know how that group of nine countries are looking at the latest proposals, but some critics say that this made in Europe idea starts to look a bit like protectionism. Mm-hmm. And there was a great line in the Bloomberg article from an unnamed EU official who said that there was less resistance to this made in Europe idea in China than in some corners of the European Commission.
Interesting. Because I guess going back to last week when we talked about the Latin America trade deal, the Mercosur trade deal, as we know, there have always been some like quite committed free traders inside the European Commission, right? Like, can you briefly, with your economics reporter hat on, explain like why those people find this alarming?
I will try. I think it's because at heart, protectionism is basically the opposite of free trade. So the big risk is that a made-in-Europe clause like this could be seen as giving European producers a clear advantage, and that might provoke retaliation mm-hmm. from our trading partners. And that matters because the EU is extremely dependent on trade. It's actually the world's largest trading entity, accounting for around 15% of all global trade in goods and services. For decades, the EU has been one of the strongest defenders of the World Trade Organization and the idea of open markets. But as you have noticed, protectionism and especially tariffs have suddenly become quite fashionable again. So there's this split. Some argue that the EU needs to adapt fast and start shielding its own industries. Others worry that this could backfire badly, given that roughly half of the EU's goods and services are exported.
Okay, so what is the argument for the made in Europe industrial idea? Like, how is it supposed to make us richer, more successful, more everything?
Well, supporters to these proposals would say it's a response to a very real problem, Europe's industrial slowdown. Across a wide range of sectors, from metals to cars to solar, European industry has been losing ground. That's due to a number of factors, but some of that is due to high fuel prices since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also weaker productivity growth than the US and parts of Asia. And it's worth pointing out that this leaked proposal has some echoes of what China did whilst it was industrializing from the late 70s onwards. Mm-hmm. So China required foreign companies to enter the market through joint ventures with local firms, a strategy that was designed to force technology transfer. So stick with me. By sharing ownership, foreign companies also shared their plans, their know-how, and intellectual property, things that otherwise would have been kept secret, but instead weren't secret, mm-hmm. which helped Chinese firms to learn quickly and build their own industrial capabilities instead of simply providing cheap labor.
And boy, are they doing some interesting things with all of that knowledge now.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look at their industry now. So yeah, you could say there's a parallel with what the EU is now trying to do with this Industrial Acceleration Act. The key, as China's experience suggests, is not to shut out foreign investment altogether, but to be subtle enough to keep it coming while encouraging learning and catch up, especially now that China itself is the technological leader in many areas like electric vehicles, solar power, and batteries. I should point out that this contrasts quite starkly with the like blunt protectionist instruments like broad tariffs, like those imposed by Donald Trump, which they are protecting some domestic producers from competition, but they've also raised costs for manufacturers by making imported intermediate goods more expensive.
Like the stuff they need to make their stuff.
Exactly. A move which is widely criticized by economists. So a more targeted technology transfer focused approach of the sort the EU appears to be aiming for may therefore attract more sympathy than like Trump's across the board protectionism. Mm-hmm. It is perhaps a bit ironic that the EU seemed to be at least to some extent imitating something that China did decades ago.
Didn't our friends at 21st Europe, you know, this think tank that we interviewed last year, they dream up like big ideas for Europe. Didn't they have a made in Europe idea as one of their big ideas?
Yeah, they did actually. In their case, I think they were proposing a new EU-wide label and certification system that like turns Europe's regulatory strengths like sustainability, safety, privacy, and traceability into a visible mark of trust for both physical products and digital services.
Oh, a bit like the fair trade label. It could be like, yeah, this is made in Europe, and that signifies all of these different things.
Exactly. it's a bit more fun to dream up something like that, I guess, than an industrial strategy, perhaps. So thanks for bringing that in. But yeah, from what I've heard, this Industrial Accelerator Act should officially be announced on January the 29th. And it could, of course, end up being different to what we've heard about now, because all of this is just based on leaks. There is a long way to go before any of this is law.
Once again, anyone with more up-to-date developments within the Commission or elsewhere, feel free to leak to us.
Hello at europeanspodcast.com. We are really hoping that 2026 will be the year that we become a fully financially sustainable operation. One in which we don't need to keep applying endlessly for the diminishing pool of grants out there that everyone else is also applying for. Mm-hmm. The only way this will become possible is if enough of our listeners decide, out of the kindness of their own hearts, to throw us a few euros or dollars or pounds or whatever currency you prefer our way each month. You can do that by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and donating as little as €4 per month.
Some lovely, lovely people did that this week. They are Damon, Marcella, Luca, Yue, Barbara, Eric, Hobbs MG, and thank you also to Dan and to Little Blue Heron, who are already supporting us but have decided to increase their donations. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
We sometimes get feedback that we don't talk enough about the United Kingdom on this podcast. Like, we just kind of pretend that there's a big gap in the sea between like France and Iceland. I think it's probably just because we're a bit self-conscious about talking about British politics, because obviously Dominic and I both sound British. And indeed, we are British citizens, along with you being German, of course, and me being a French citizen.
It's true.
So we feel a bit guilty if there's an episode of The Europeans where literally every voice you hear has a British accent and we're talking about the UK. Like, it doesn't feel very pan-European. Anyway, it is a New Year's resolution of mine to talk a little bit more about our home country on this podcast from time to time when something big or something weird happens. Because the UK is a European country too, of course, even if it is no longer in the European Union. It is part of the European family. And while we've been avoiding talking about the UK on this podcast, some quite interesting stuff has actually been happening in terms of Britain's relationship with the EU. Keir Starmer's new-ish Labour government has been pursuing what it is calling a reset with the European Union. So no plans to rejoin the EU, but very much trying to move past the super combative relationship that the former Conservative government often had with the EU. What does that mean in practice? Well, it means a few things. For one thing, the UK is currently trying to negotiate a deal to reduce the insane volume of paperwork now needed to export food between the UK and the EU. For another, they're trying to get the UK integrated back into the main European electricity market, which will hopefully make electricity bills a bit cheaper for Brits. And at the end of last year, you might have seen the news that the UK is rejoining the Erasmus scheme, which is being widely celebrated by people who want to do student exchanges and many others. What else this reset actually means remains to be seen. And some critics of the UK's Labour government are sceptical that this is going to bring anything meaningful beyond just talking a little bit more kindly about the people on the other side of the English Channel. Some other critics are looking at the state of British domestic politics at the moment and saying, well, you know, it's nice that you guys are trying to get on better terms with the EU, but is this centre-left government of Keir Starmer's even going to last that long? Like, they're not doing fantastically in the polls. So what should we make of this whole EU reset business? Is anything going to come of it? We were very lucky this week to talk to the person leading the reset negotiations. He's the Minister for the Cabinet Office, a job that includes European Union relations, Nick Thomas Simmons. This interview is brought to you in collaboration with our radio partners at Euronet Plus.
Nick Thomas Simmons, thank you for joining us today on The Europeans.
Absolute pleasure.
I'd like to start by talking a bit about the British economy, which I think it's fair to say has struggled in recent years with weak growth and productivity compared to many of its peers. To what extent do you think Brexit has contributed to these difficulties?
We've never hid from the fact that we had a very tough economic inheritance. I think we inherited a situation where, you're absolutely right, there had been significant long-term issues with productivity. We had public services on their knees in a real sense going around the country, as I was in 2024, that things just didn't work anymore. And I think you're absolutely right to highlight the previous government's handling of Brexit, and particularly the trade and cooperation agreement that we inherited. And then we got that mandate to improve the relationship in the 2024 general election. We said we wouldn't rejoin the single market or customs union or go back to freedom of movement. But we did set out that we would be building that closer relationship. And I have to say, I've been extremely pleased with progress, a very close, constructive relationship with my EU counterpart, Maroš Šefčovič. And indeed, across Europe, the reset is visible in terms of that much more positive relationship. Only last week, I was in Paris for a very productive discussion with my counterpart there, Benjamin Haddad, discussing a range of issues in the UK-EU reset, including security and energy that, in my view, are absolutely critical, both the EU and the UK.
You've talked about now being the time for ruthless pragmatism when it comes to UK-EU relations. What does ruthless actually mean here? I mean, being ruthless implies, to me at least, that someone's going to feel some pain as a result of this strategy. Who exactly do you envisage as feeling that pain?
It certainly isn't designed to produce pain. What it's designed to do is to produce material advantages for people. But the reason I used that phrase is because I'm somebody who, over the 11 years I've been a Member of Parliament, has been right through the different aspects of the Brexit debate. And for too long, I saw it as one that was being dominated by ideology over what was in people's interests. So that's why I use the term ruthless pragmatism, moving away from that to an absolute focus and decisiveness about what is the best outcome for people on either side of the channel that isn't related to some preconceived ideological idea. And that's exactly the approach I've taken that delivered the common understanding back in May of last year, and that delivered just before Christmas, which I'm very proud of, which is the reaccession of the United Kingdom to Erasmus+, which I think will produce benefits for thousands of people, both here in the United Kingdom but across Europe as well. But also the opening of talks on electricity trading, which is going to be critical both for energy security and one of the tools we can use to bear down on energy prices too.
Things like the Erasmus thing coming back are nice. You're not going to see that much opposition to it. But when people hear talk of a reset in UK-EU relations, some are sceptical that that is going to amount to anything more than warm words and a handful of nice symbolic things, such as cooperation on, indeed, student exchanges. What would you say to somebody who thinks that this reset is deliberately modest because you're worried about getting domestic political backlash from voters who were pro-Brexit?
So the only thing I would just challenge slightly in your question is that Erasmus Plus isn't only a student exchange program. It's often understood that way, but it is far more than that. It's also about vocational exchanges, sports exchanges. There is a real breadth and range to Erasmus Plus. But to your central point, again, I would challenge the idea that this is simply a modest reset. The food and drink agreement is going to be worth billions of pounds to the economy, but also the emissions trading system linkage, which will have that exemption from the carbon border adjustment mechanism, which will mean British businesses will be able to save hundreds of millions of pounds in carbon taxes they would otherwise have had to pay. My challenge to anyone who wants to argue against the work I'm doing is that, do they really want to take away additional sharing, additional tools that make people in this country safer? Do they want to take away the security and defence partnership at this critical moment, international politics? And do they want to say to businesses up and down the country, you are going to have to pay these costs again? Do they want to actually say to people, whether it's energy bills or whether it is in the price of the weekly shop, they want to risk those things going up? Because that is the dividing line between the approach that we are taking and those who oppose it.
Do you feel like the mood of the British public is shifting in a way that gives you more or less room for manoeuvre when it comes to collaborating with the EU?
Well, I actually think that the mood of the British public is very close to the approach that we've been taking. I think there is a real public appetite for the closer UK-EU relationship we're trying to build. But I also get a sense that people want to look forward. They don't want to go back to the battles of the past. And that's precisely the approach the government takes.
In the current geopolitical climate, defence and security cooperation seem to matter more than ever. Do you think the UK should be seeking a more structured role in EU defence initiatives, or do you see NATO as the primary framework, even as one NATO member is threatening another NATO member?
Well, look, NATO is the foundation stone, but with regard to the issue you quite rightly raised around Greenland, the Prime Minister has been unequivocal about that in a press conference only a few hours before we are speaking on this podcast, that the future of Greenland is a matter for the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark, and has set out that the use of tariffs is completely wrong. So we've been unequivocal in our position on that. But in terms of the broader point about European security, security is in Europe a continent-wide challenge. Whether you are an EU member state or whether you are not, that challenge exists for us. And it exists for us because of Putin's illegal invasion of Ukraine back in February 2022. We have a return. I never thought necessarily I would see it in my lifetime, of a return to land war in Europe. And again, the coalition of the willing is hugely important. Whether you see the E3, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, or indeed the wider diplomatic work that the Prime Minister conducts on behalf of the United Kingdom, you don't need to take my word for it that there's been a reset. You only need to see the close cooperation between them and the relationship, the warm, constructive relationship that exists between the Prime Minister and other European leaders, to see that in action.
We have listeners all over Europe, and they're very interested in what's happening at home in the UK, as well as the UK's place in Europe and the wider world. You are widely seen as one of Keir Starmer's closest political allies. From where you sit, what is the mood actually like inside Number 10 Downing Street right now? I mean, Labour is polling around the mid-teens behind Reform, the Conservatives, in some polls even behind the Greens. That seems to be a serious political problem.
Well, the message that we pick up on the doorstep is very much about change. And the Prime Minister has said that 2026 will be the year when we start to turn that corner. And if you just think about some of the measures that we've already taken that will come into effect this year, the £150 off people's energy bills, the abolition of the two-child limit so that families up and down the country with more children will be able to access that support. And that, by the way, is a real investment in children's futures. So it's a determination to deliver that you'll find right across the government, and indeed being led by Number 10.
Isn't it a bit of a problem that EU leaders look at these polls in the UK as well? Like, why would they take long-term UK commitments seriously if the UK government itself looks politically fragile with reform on the rise?
If you are conducting and delivering international agreements, as we are, that produce material benefits on both sides, then logic would tell you that they become very hard to unpick by subsequent governments. And that is why it is so vital now we do move towards, as we are, implementation to deliver that tangible change.
What's happening in politics in the UK is something that's being mirrored in many ways across the continent in terms of the rise of the far right. If the European Union was to move in that direction politically, with even stronger influence from parties led by figures like Jordan Bardella or Giorgia Meloni, How would that affect your vision of what closer UK-EU cooperation will look like in the years to come?
Well, firstly, in relation to Prime Minister Meloni, who I've met on more than one occasion, we work very well with Prime Minister Meloni and her government in Italy. But more broadly, look, it is a matter for democracies who they choose as their leaders. It's not for us to choose the leaders of different democracies. It's up to them. We will work with whoever our allies choose as their leaders. And these are deep historic relationships that go beyond whoever happens to be the Prime Minister here or indeed the leader of other countries. These are very deep, lasting relationships, and I'm sure they will continue to be long into the future.
One final question before we let you go. You talked about having a good relationship with Giorgia Meloni, and I wanted to know which other political leaders or figures within the EU do you find it easiest to work with, and how much do these personal relationships still matter in international diplomacy?
They hugely matter, and of course my main relationship is with Commissioner Šefčovič because he is the one that I negotiate with on a regular basis. We are taken to sharing the odd drink together. He is more in the Slovakian red wine territory. I'm much more in the whiskey territory. I've particularly been persuading him of late into Welsh whiskey. And I do think that relationship really matters. And of course, it doesn't mean that we don't really push he the interests of the EU, me the interests of the United Kingdom. Of course we do. But the constructive, friendly relationship we have, I think, really does make a difference to our ability to get things done.
This is a question we should ask all political guests, Dominic. Do you stick to national priorities and national exports when having drinks with European counterparts? Nick Thomas Simmons, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
One of the things I found most interesting and telling about that interview is the fact that the minister actually wanted to speak to us.
Yeah, interesting, right?
Like, it does really suggest to me that the UK has like an explicit strategy for outreach towards the continent. I mean, can you imagine a previous Europe minister over the last 10 years being sent onto our podcast?
Yeah, I think we would have had a very different conversation with that person. People who've only started listening to the Europeans quite recently, they probably don't realise that for a long time, we had an almost total ban on even mentioning Brexit, because we were just so sick of hearing about it in the British media. It just took up all of the oxygen. So I'm glad that that's one very small way in which politics has become slightly less exhausting over the past couple of years, even if it's become more exhausting in basically every other way.
That's true.
Yay, silver linings. But yeah, I am very intrigued to see if meaningful things come of this reset. It'd be nice to have some concrete, boring things to celebrate coming out of dull negotiations, wouldn't it?
It sure would. And I think we can agree that an electricity market is a boring thing.
More boring agreements, please. Time to head to the Inspiration Station. What have you been enjoying, Dominic?
Well, firstly, I saw the Northern Lights for the first time last night out of my bedroom window.
What, from Amsterdam? You could see them?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
That's so
cool. I have
this
app which tells me when you might see it, and it was like going mad. I got a notification.
Wow.
Aurora notifier. Anyway, it worked, and I saw these amazing, beautiful green stripes across the sky.
So cool.
Does that count as European culture?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a recommendation. It's like, be somewhere where you can see cool stuff out the window.
Anyway, I do have a more conventional thing to bring into the Inspiration Station. It was the European Film Awards this past weekend, the 38th edition. And I have to be honest, I've never really noticed this award ceremony happening.
No.
But this year, the organizers did something quite clever. They moved the ceremony from December, when it usually is, to January, so that the awards would get more attention, because we're currently in the midst of that busy time of the so-called awards season, which culminates in the Oscars this year in mid-March. And the idea was that placing this often overlooked European film ceremony between the Golden Globes and the Oscars might shine more light on the ceremony and give a bit of momentum to some of the European films that could be in contention at the Oscars.
Ah, clever.
They apparently also employed a stellar social media team because my Instagram was full of acceptance speeches from those awards the day after, which
has
never been the case before. And the film that swept the board at the European Film Awards, collecting 6 trophies, is a film that is getting a lot of awards buzz in general, also in the US, a Norwegian film called Sentimental Value. Have you heard about it?
Not on my radar.
It's made by Joachim Trier and it stars the amazing Norwegian actor Renate Reinsfer and the man playing her father, Stellan Skarsgård, who actually won a Golden Globe for this role earlier this month. I went to see Sentimental Value at the cinema over the Christmas holidays and I just completely loved it. I have to say, I was a bit skeptical about watching yet another film about a brilliant filmmaker father who is absent from his children's life. Just a few days before, I'd watched the new George Clooney Noah Baumbach film, Jay Kelly, on Netflix, which has basically got the same premise. So I was like, really? Another one?
It's a bit like novels about writers, which, as you know, I can't stand.
Yeah. That film, Jay Kelly, does not really need to be watched, in my opinion. This film, however, is so beautiful. It's about so many different things. It's about the love between two sisters. It's about intergenerational trauma, the power of theatre and film, the importance of a home. It's so good. Go and watch it.
Aww.
Many of you will probably have seen Joachim Trier's previous film, The Worst Person in the World, also starring Renate Reinsfer. I loved that film too, but I think this is even better and I'm really happy it's getting all this awards attention. It just feels correct. So go watch Sentimental Value and yeah, I also recommend you go and watch Joachim Trier's acceptance speech at the European Film Awards. It's gone a bit viral. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. In it, he makes a moving case for freedom of expression, freedom of the arts, and the power of the arts to counteract polarization. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I am going to borrow a recommendation from one of our listeners this week. Johannes recommended a recent piece of writing in the Paris Review, and it is a review of 13 types of bottled water written by the Spanish/Argentinian filmmaker Amalia Ullman. Apart from being a successful filmmaker, Amalia is also, I have now learned, a trained water sommelier.
No way.
Do you know what a water sommelier is?
Well, I mean, I can guess. Someone who tastes water.
Exactly. It's like a wine expert, but for water. Very much like how a wine sommelier can taste a wine and be like, oh, yes, this is a Bordeaux from 2023 or whatever. A water sommelier is trained to appreciate the different mineral notes that one water might have compared to another. Anyway, the Spanish filmmaker, Amalia Ullman, is a trained water sommelier. She got her accreditation at this very fancy water school in Germany. And she has written this rather delightful piece that is half travelogue and half water review. It's about her going to the annual meeting of the Water Sommelier Union, which held its latest meeting in the Czech Republic. So it is sort of a travel diary of this trip. But it's also reviewing all of the water that she drinks along the way. And it's very deadpan and funny. It includes a bottle of water that she bought at a McDonald's, 1 star.
Is it only about bottled water?
Oh, tell a lie. One of them is a review of the water that she drank at Source Nature Reserve in the Czech Republic. She also gave that a 1 star rating. She said it smelled like rotten eggs and tasted of period blood. Yum, yum. Oh.
I really want to go and read this, but I also find it a bit ethically questionable to have water sommeliers, considering we should be drinking tap water if we can, because of the environmental impact.
Funnily enough, I actually work with somebody who is a water sommelier in her secret life that is not teaching at the university, and she loves Parisian tap water.
Ah, there you go.
So, Johannes, thank you for sharing this. I know that you didn't share it as an offering for the Inspiration Station per se, merely as a piece of writing that other appreciators of all things deadpan might enjoy in our Patreon chat. But I thought it deserved a wider audience, so I will put a link to it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. For my happy ending this week, I'm taking us to the mountains of Austria, where the hills are alive with the sound of Veronica the cow scratching her back with a broom.
Would you like to explain what the hell you're on about?
Well, my happy news is that some scientists are reevaluating the intelligence of cows after it was brought to their attention that this one Swiss brown cow that lives in Austria near the border of Italy...
Oh, she's a migrant.
...uses a broom to scratch her back.
How, though?
She does it with her mouth, with the broom in her mouth, and she scratches the different bits of her back that need scratching.
Wow, I need to see a video of this Veronica. Let me Google her right now.
So Veronica is a pet cow. She lives with an organic farmer and baker called Witke Wiegeler. I realise that sounds like a made-up name, but this is definitely not a made-up story, I promise. Witke has always known that Veronica was a special cow. She not only learned how to scratch herself with a tool, but she also responds to the voices of family members.
Wow, clever cow. I'm just watching her do it now. It is mesmerizing. She's so clever. She's just really unmistakably using this to scratch her back with.
So what happened is a clip of Veronica doing the scratching started doing the rounds, and it caught the attention of some researchers at Vienna's University of Veterinary Medicine, because the use of a tool by livestock has never been documented by scientists. We know that many birds, chimps, dolphins, and even octopuses can use tools, but we didn't know that cows could do that too. And it's not only that she is using a tool, but she is using both ends of the tool, making it officially a multi-purpose tool. And use of multi-purpose tools have only been convincingly confirmed in studies of chimps. And of course, humans can do it too, although I often struggle with use of multi-purpose tools while doing my DIY. I'll share a link to a video of Veronica scratching in the show notes. What's really cool about this research is that the scientists don't think that Veronica is unique. They just think that we've been underestimating the intelligence of cows. And in truth, not many cows live until 13 years old, like Veronica. So maybe if more cows were kept as pets and kind of treated as part of the family, like Veronica clearly has been, and not used in the meat or dairy industry, we'd have noticed how clever these animals are.
That is it for this week. The show was produced this week by Morgan Childs in Prague and Wojciech Aleksiak in Warsaw. Thank you both. Next week, I'm going to have someone else for company, I think, because you're away, I believe, Dominic.
Yes, you're going to have another mystery guest.
Tune in to hear me joined by that mystery guest. In the meantime, sign up to get our newsletter in your inbox. It is so good. And you can also find us on selected social media platforms, Instagram, YouTube, Mastodon, and Blue Sky. Have fun singing next week, Dominic.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Cheers.
Moo.